rejection, and the second filter is going to give me 30 dB rejection, and I put the two filters cascaded, yes, I will get 60 dB of rejection, skirt rejection, on the side filter, you know, a frequency off to one side of the center of the filter, if there's a circulator there. Without the circulator, the number you're going to get can be anything in the world because the two filters interact. There's a lot of things that interact if you don't use circulators. So in the case of the broadcast world, I can see there's a lot of advantage in using a circulator to protect your early stages. And I guess you could even use it at the antenna itself to make sure that you're not getting triple transit signals bouncing back and forth in the transmission line, which in the old days would give you ghosting in the picture. I wonder if anyone has ever used circulators to avoid ghosting in the picture, Eric. KE2EJ, K2RIW in the TechNet.
K2RIW, KE2EJ. Actually, at the kind of power levels that we're talking about, this is a little hard. Could have done, but nobody does that. The reality is that when you put your antenna system together, you're talking about having reflections that are almost unmeasurable. I mean, the total path between where the transmitter feeds the feed line and the antenna itself, you're talking about numbers that are like 1 to 1.017 or 0.035. They managed to design it so it's a close tolerance at a particular frequency. And they did actually have little ghost cancellers, little delay lines in essence, but once the GCR came into being, everybody forgot that those things even existed, so. K2RW, K3J.
Yeah, I'm pretty sure you're coming in by Echolink or IRLP tonight. Out of curiosity, Erica, where are you located right now? You're sounding quite good.
Okay, we just got off the train in Hicksville, coming back from the city, we went to see a show tonight. And in about another 10 minutes, I'll be home.
How about that? So I think that means you're talking to us by way of a cell phone. Is that what you're doing, Erica? Go ahead.
That's correct, Dave. And a lot of other people do the same thing.
Yeah, Rich, K2UPS does that when he's traveling through Pennsylvania, Ohio, West Virginia, and so on. Okay, if you Google the word circulator or isolator, ferrite circulator, ferrite isolator, you will find a lot of further information. It's not going to be super easy to understand. To view it as a black box, as a circuit that allows the signal to flow in one direction and won't allow it to come back, that's the main thing it does. But the method, internally, what's going on to make that happen in a thoroughly passive circuit, there's a bit of magic going on there. It's called gyrotropy. Heavily biased magnetic field going into a piece of ferrite with the right kind of a coaxial, with the right kind of transmission line circuit will do that for you. KC2WGB, K2RIW, go ahead, John.
John, I just want to say one more thing here. That, in the broadcast world in microwave, and when we stack a bunch of microwave receivers together, or you stack a bunch of microwave transmitters together, they're all sitting in the same hunk of waveguide. In essence, you've got circulators on the ends of them where port number three is connected to port number one, and port number three below it is connected to port number one, and so on and so forth, and that's how you stack them together.
You got it, John.
Okay, very good. Very good. Yeah, we got a few questions in tonight. And that's it from the mailbag. And let's go over to Paul. I'm sure he's got a lot for us. And another fun night. Back to you, Dick. KC2WGB.
Yeah, Paul's going to be giving us a pretty exciting presentation tonight. space report number 217, I think. Maybe it's 218, we'll find out. But where Elon Musk was supposedly doing a test rocket firing when this explosion occurred on the launch pad, and the payload was on, and this very expensive payload was on top of that rocket, and therefore it became damaged, it became destroyed. So I'm curious, why was it called a test firing when it was a pure vertical stack, looked like it was ready to go? So what was really going on there, Paul? WS2N with the space report, K2RIW, you got it, Paul.
Oh, good evening, Dick. WS2N, and yeah, it's number 217. And I was wanted to come on here and start talking about how the Falcon 9 is about to refly on a commercial flight, one of the boosters that came back last April that landed successfully for the first time on a drone ship out at sea. It was one of the flights that sent cargo up to the International Space Station. That booster has now been approved to relaunch, and the company that chose to do it is SES. They come out of Luxembourg. It's the biggest company that puts geosynchronous satellites into orbit, and they run over 50 of them at a time. So they've been with SpaceX from the beginning. Let me drop it. So the day before this accident, the news came out that they confirmed that they were going to be the first company to refly a satellite on a reused booster. Of course, this is the Elon Musk of SpaceX. Goal is to bring down the cost of launching satellites into space, bring the cost down. He's down to around $60 million a flight, you know, per booster. So he's substantially less than, for instance, ULA that launches the Atlas. He's probably less than half, and he wants to reduce that even more. So he's brought back a half a dozen of these boosters now, successfully. And all since December of last year, so, you know, within a like 9-month period. So he's doing quite well. And along comes September 1st with this next rocket that was scheduled to go up, AMOS, AMOS, built by Israel. Let me drop it. And you're right, it was an expensive satellite scheduled to go to a geosynchronous orbit. It was going to take care of communications in Africa, Mid-East, Europe, once it was at geosynchronous orbit. And it was a $200 million piece of equipment. And this Israel company is the one that put it together and is paying SpaceX to get it there. So now what goes on the launch pad? Every flight that SpaceX launches, now this is number, I think number 26 out of all the flights, they do what's called a static firing test. The first thing that they do is they build a rocket, and they take the 9 Merlin engines, and they put it on the first stage, and the 1 Merlin engine, which is vacuum operated, and they put that on the second stage, and what they do is they fire each rocket individually before it's mounted to the stage. After that's done, now this all takes place in McGregor, Texas. After that's done, they do the same thing except all the rockets at McGregor, Texas, with no payload. And after that successful test, they ship it off to Florida. and then they stacked the payload on top. Originally, they were doing it without the payloads a couple of years ago, but then they started to put the payload on top. It's more cost effective.
Repeater, timeout. Repeater, timeout. Cancel.
Saves a couple of days in doing that. So what they did is, what they've done for all the flights, they've launched flights out of Vandenberg Air Force Base and many flights out of Cape Canaveral, Launch Complex 40, which they lease from NASA, or as far as I'm concerned, they own it. They've rebuilt this whole complex many years ago, and that's what they've been flying there. They're Falcons out of. They put the rocket on the stand, and they static fire it. All the engines light off temporarily, a couple of seconds. The rocket is bolted down; it's not going anywhere. And then they say it's now ready for flight. Well, they were getting ready to do that. They were about a couple of minutes away from actually lighting those engines off for a test. This was on the 1st, and the planned launch of Amos was on Friday, usually 2-3 days down the road. So they got within about a few minutes of the actual test, and they were still loading the cryogenics onto the spacecraft. The bottom part of the spacecraft is all RP-1 rocket propellant fuel, kerosene basically. And then the top part of the rocket is liquid oxygen. And normally they, you know, before they started with this, this they call it densification of the rocket fuels years ago, they used to chill it down to a certain temperature and then launch it. Now, by bringing the fuel and the oxidizer, roughly an extra 50 degrees lower on each, they could...
Repeater, timeout. Repeater, timeout. Cancel.
Rocket engines and everything, they're putting out a lot more power than when they first started flying these things years ago, roughly about 30% more power. And that's why they're able to launch heavier loads and geosynchronous orbit, and that's why they're able to attempt to land these rockets back at sea or sometimes bring them back to Cape Canaveral.
Yeah, we've got to let the machine totally drop, Paul, because we've timed out, and I think the 375 has not come back to life yet. Stand by. Okay, 375 is back. Go ahead, Paul.
Yeah, sorry about that. Okay. So, basically, that's what they do. They never got to the test, and apparently something let loose, and it looks like near the upper stage. And that's curious because 2 Junes ago, when SpaceX had their failure with a cargo flight to the International Space Station, that was CRS number 8, it got off the launch pad and it was about to separate from the second stage, and the whole thing blew up, and that knocked them out of business for quite a long time to try to correct that problem. And they decided it was in the upper stage in the liquid oxygen tank itself. With inside the liquid oxygen tank, they have another small tank filled with helium, and the helium creates pressure as fuel is leaving the rocket. Oxygen is leaving the tank. Helium, and which is inert, replaces it to keep the pressure stabilized inside the tank. Well, this small tank inside the oxygen tank is supported, and they have these brackets I think they call them truss pieces from one end of the tank to the other, and they decided that these truss pieces were inadequate. supplier, and they changed suppliers, and they believe they got this all corrected. But I'm going to be, you know, interested in finding out what caused the problem. If you look at the replay on the explosion, it looks like it's coming right from about the same area that the last problem was. So, you know, maybe they didn't get that corrected. This is going to put the space program as far as cargo and satellites probably way behind schedule. If it's a major problem, if they have to rework the Falcon 9 rocket, we drop it. He's got, you know, some 50 or 60 flights on his manifest that have to go up. Some, you know, like I think $5 billion worth of satellites that he has to put up to space. Most of his flights have nothing to do with NASA. You know, it's independent flights such as the one that blew up. He's got a lot of contracts signed. He's got to get things going again. And to do that, he's got to figure out what caused this problem and get it fixed. For instance, if they find out if it's a support problem, you know, coming from Launch Complex 40, then all is well. They'll be able to take the same Falcon 9 rockets and launch them, not only, you know, instead of Launch Complex 40, Cape Canaveral, we'll put down the road a couple miles to Launch Complex 39A. Let me drop it. 39A, again, they're taking over. SpaceX is taking it over from NASA. That's the big launch complex, 39A, 39B. They're the ones that the Apollo flights have taken off from, and the shuttle flights have taken off from. And now SpaceX has taken over one of those two big complexes. And they were actually getting ready to send up the Falcon 9 Heavy. Falcon 9 Heavy is essentially a Falcon 9 rocket. There's three of them that they bolt together, and they're going to shoot it up at one time. Well, they got to get this problem fixed before they even think about doing that. But it is a plan to launch people from that launch complex as well. So in the meantime, they think they could actually launch their rockets, their satellite rockets, and their cargo missions that they have contracted with NASA from Launch Complex 39A. Let me drop it. I'll turn it back to you for any questions. Because, you know, there's a lot to SpaceX, and I try to go back in case somebody's listening that doesn't follow us on a regular basis. So I know a lot of it sounds repetitious, but I'll turn it back to you. There's other things for the SpaceNet if we get off this topic, but I know this is a very important topic. Could put, I believe it's going to put the manned flights that are scheduled to launch from Cape Canaveral probably behind schedule, at least a year back either.
The stock took a nosedive too.
You just said it's going to put it back a year. Gee, that sounds like a lot. And so a $200 million payload got burned up. I wonder if there's insurance that covers that. Somehow I doubt it. Do you think that payload is insured, Paul? Go ahead. By the way, when it comes to analyzing what took place, what the error was, and what's correcting, what the corrective procedure is, are you being conservative when you think it's going to take as long as a year to iron that all out? I'm back to you, Paul.
Normally I would have said 6 months, but they've got some other issues. They're building the Dragon cargo version, and he's got problems when he tested in salt water. He's got some kind of leaks going on. He's getting salt water into the chambers, and there's some other issues, safety issues, that aren't being addressed quick enough for NASA's sake. And you know, it's not only this. I mean, this is really going to set them back, but there are other problems. And Boeing has some problems with the Starliner, the one that they're building for NASA to send people up to. They've got some issues with weight, and they're trying to find a way to cut back weight. And, I think that, you know, overall, it looks like maybe Boeing now could beat SpaceX. I've been thinking that SpaceX is going to be the first one to launch people. If this slows them down, what I think is going to slow them down is you know, they don't have a complex now, launch complex. Boy, is gone. They do have another one out in California, out in Vandenberg. They've been flying out of Launch Complex 4, and they've taken that thing over, similar to what they've done in Florida. And they have launched a couple of flights out of there, and they could launch a couple more, but most of them are usually polar-type flights out of Vandenberg. He needs to get his, you know, his main work, which is geosynchronous satellites up. They're the big payers. NASA, of course, is a big payer, so, to keep it going. I didn't hear about the stock, by the way, John. Back to you.
Repeater, timeout. Repeater, timeout. Cancel.
Hey, Jack. Go ahead, Eric. SES Americom is one of the largest geosynchronous satellite guys. They get multiple stages of insurance during construction, from time of writing the contract all the way to launch. And one of the big players is Lloyd's of London. There are a couple of others, but SES insures every one of the devices that ride on a vehicle.
Okay, this is an SES, but let me take it for a second there. SES, they're just phenomenally large. But this is AMOS. In fact, they were scheduled to be bought up, the company that built it. But now that's on hold because they're not going to be able to make money with this thing blowing up. If it was in space, they were going to be making $15 million or something right off the first couple of months of operation. So that's not going to happen. Insurance-wise, this particular satellite was insured from launch, from, you know, T0 up. That was their insurance. But they did have a secondary insurance for preparation. So, you know, if they dropped the satellite, you know, in the processing facility or if it blew up on the launch pad before takeoff, it's a different, they happen to take a different insurance policy out. So I understand they are insured for that $200 million. Back to you, Dick.
Now, many of us have seen that explosion on video. And you see the payload falling off the top of the rocket, crashing down onto the pavement, so to speak, fire and flame all over the place. I didn't even consider the fact the launch pad itself got heavily damaged. Is that launch pad going to be useless for a long period of time, Paul? I know the rocket obviously got disintegrated, but you've got four towers nearby which are acting as lightning arresters. They look like they're still there. But I guess the launch pad itself, did massive portions of that get melted down? That's hard to replace, Paul. WS2N, K2RIW.
Yeah, I haven't seen close-up views, although I've tried to look for it on the internet and trying to get some kind of reports. I know the strongback, they call it the strongback, that holds up the rocket. You know, it's got big hydraulics that bring it up vertical. Backs off right before launch. They said that's heavily damaged, although that did look like it was still vertical when I was looking at the picture, but they said it's heavily damaged. That will have to be replaced. The four towers, I did notice they were all up. And by the way, if you ever look real close at any of those four towers, you could see a wire going from tower to tower to tower. Did you ever see that, Dick?
No, I haven't.
about it, but I can make some guesses as to why that's there. Those towers are made to be a taller grounded structure than the rocket itself. So in the worst case situation, lightning is supposed to strike that structure and not your rocket. Over you, Cole, as a guess on my part.
Yeah, they have them linked. You see one square going from tower to tower to tower. And then another piece of wire coming out, like toward the rocket, you know, a distance. Oh, I'm going to pick a distance, you know, say 50 feet. And then another square, an inner square attached to that. So it's, you know, every rocket that goes off goes between these wires. If you got to look, you know, bring up something on your computer or a magazine of a launch and look real close, and you can see the fine wire going from tower to tower to tower. And I was trying to see if that survived, but I did see the 400-foot towers did survive. Now, on the ground, there's a tremendous amount of piping, and there's tanks and all kinds of equipment that they said blew up. All these secondary explosions. The explosions were going on for over 4 minutes after the initial explosion. So what caused that initial explosion? You know, was it some other part of another helium tank that dislodged inside? You know, for some unknown reason, they were filling up these, all of them filling up. And, both fuel and oxygen on both first and second stage. So I'm going to be real curious to find out what the cause is, and see if that first, you know, the first accident from 2 Junes ago was really the problem, or was there something else? Seems very similar to me. So I'm looking forward to see what the answer is. Back to you, Dick.
I guess no one has estimated yet when that particular launch pad will be back in operation. Sounds like a lot of repairs are required. And so I guess you're saying that Elon Musk has to fall back to some other launch pad, like 39A or 39B, if he's got something else ready to go. But this sounds like his main lead spacecraft, so to speak. So I guess he's not going to be launching anything for quite a while until this is thoroughly understood. Is that true, Paul? And you could go on to your next report if you want to. WS2N, K2RIW.
Yeah, I think it's going to be some time. It's got to be at least 6 months, which will put some bit of a strain on the astronauts on the International Space Station. You have Orbital ATK, which has got scheduled to go up. They've been out of business almost 2 years. This October would be 2 years as far as Launch Complex Zero in Wallops Island, Virginia. Back in 2 Octobers ago, they launched from there and the whole thing blew up, and that was due to an engine failure. They were using a Russian engine, an NK-33 engine, and now since then that now has been replaced by RD-181, new Russian engines, which are supposed to be highly reliable. And they're finally going to be returning to flight probably within another month or two. They've actually returned to flight sending their Cygnus spacecraft up, but they borrowed an Atlas rocket. Let me try that. Two Atlas V rockets from ULA, the United Launch Alliance, and last year they sent up two spacecraft to the International Space Station, two enhanced Cygnus spacecraft. They were much bigger than the original Cygnus spacecraft. Now those enhanced spacecraft will be sent up now from Virginia, probably within a month or two. So that'll get some more supplies up to the space station. But this is going to push it back a little bit, and maybe the Cygnus might not fly by the way, it flies on a rocket called Antares, Antares rocket, because when they did a similar test, a static fire test on that launch pad 2 months ago, they did notice some vibration, so I haven't heard that they've cured that problem. So that would only leave two cargo ships left to bring supplies to the space station. Let me drop it.
Think of myself, darling!
Yeah. The Progress spacecraft and the Japanese HTV. So, I had to bring that up. Another article, that I was going to talk about is the EVA. Another successful EVA by, stand by. Do I got to wait for this to reset, Dick?
I think you can proceed, Paul.
Understood. There was another EVA, which also happened on September 1st, from the International Space Station. They left the Quest module to do some work on the space station. And when I say they, it was Jeff Williams and Kate Rubin. By the way, Jeff Williams' call is KD5TVQ. And Kate Rubin's is KG5FYJ, and they're both hams, of course, and they did a great job. Their goal was to fold up or collapse a ammonia panel that needed to be reset, brought back into its original position. They don't need that anymore, and that was successful. They added a couple of HD cameras out there. And a couple of other get-ahead work that they needed to do on the space station, including working on the rotating joint that turns the solar arrays on the port side. They needed to do some work on that. It was all very successful, and they completed everything within a little over 6 hours. And I have a tremendous amount of details on that, but I'm not going to go on unless you are. Back to you, Dick. K2RIWWS2N for the SpaceNet report on the TechNet.
KE2EJ, K2RIW, are you there, Eric?
Yeah, yeah, give me a second, I'm looking to see where it's coming from.
Roger, Doctor.
Sign back on again, but it's not showing. I'm not showing it's being transmitted. Hold on, let me double check.
Disconnected.
It just went away. And I'm looking to see. Oh yes, we got 975375 is back in operation. Okay, we've cured that problem. Or at least we've got a clue as to what's going on. Once again, Paul, what exactly does Elon Musk have now to do launching with? I guess Launchpad 40 is the one he was using. It looks like that had a fairly serious meltdown. It's going to take a significant number of months to put that back in operation. Does he have any other launch pad that he can fall back to? I think you said he can use 39A or 39B if he had another vehicle that was ready to go. You may have already said that, and maybe I've got a little, maybe I've got that a little bit mixed up. WS2N, K2IW.
This is WS2N. Well, he's got the one rocket, and that's Falcon 9. And he has in mind four launch pads to be used within, probably within another 2 years. And four are two in California, two in Florida, one in California, and the other one is in Texas. The one in Texas, he's still building. He wants to launch cargo, satellites, and eventually crews from Boca Chica, which is near Brownsville, Texas. And he's been building that place for years. But of course, right now it's not ready. And he's probably got another year or two to go on that. In California, he has, for polar orbits and for some science missions, he launched Discover to an L1 position for NASA a couple of years ago from Vandenberg Air Force Base. He also launched the Jason mission also from Vandenberg. That was a polar orbiting satellite. He needs to have something for geosynchronous, and he uses the LC-40. Let me drop it. Launch Complex 40. I remember, oh man, it must have been about 2008 or something. He was working on that complex, rebuilding it, took it over from NASA. And tremendous amount of work that went into that. And that's why I'm thinking that's going to be down for a long time. All kinds of tanks and piping, never mind the wiring and everything, but the structural stuff that I'm sure has to be all redone now. Took many years to do. That's not going to be ready anytime soon. Now, from Florida, he's been working for the last 3.5 years on Launch Complex 39A. 39A and 39B were complexes that were used by NASA to put up Apollo and the space shuttle. Let me drop it. The space shuttles went up. Sometimes they went off Launch Complex 39. Sometimes they went off Launch Complex 39B. Even one time they had two shuttles out there sitting on launch pad at one time during the last Hubble service mission. They did that because they planned on having a second space shuttle ready in case there needed to be a rescue on that mission. So that was their big complex in 39A, 39B. Now NASA doesn't need 39A anymore. They just need 39B. For that, they're building the launch complex for the Space Launch System, and that's going to be a Mars rocket eventually. And the Space Launch Complex for the Space Launch System is going to be one massive rocket that NASA's building. So that's 39B, so that, they can't go there. Let me drop it. That's being reworked by NASA. But they have taken over 39A. And 39A, by the way, historically is the launch pad that Neil Armstrong took off from when he went to the moon. So, now that thing, it was just going to be used this November for the Falcon 9 Heavy. Falcon 9 Heavy is the three Falcon 9s that are bolted together. And he was going to send a test flight up to show that he could do that. But I think that's going to be delayed now because of this accident. It's also being built for other Falcon 9s that can launch from there. So you can launch geosynchronous satellites. He could fulfill his mission, his contract missions to the International Space Station from 39A by sending the cargo missions up. And eventually planned, they had planned them on launching crews from 39A anyway to the space station. So nothing is going to stop that work. So, you know, they have a plan B, but what are you going to do with, you know, the engineers got to get together and figure out what caused this problem. They're working within 35 milliseconds of time of when this thing blew up to try to figure out the problem. Yeah, but the engineers are working on it. There's 3,000 pieces of information, telemetry that they're looking at, 3,000. So, I mean, they should be able to iron out the problem and figure out what this is. Back to you there.
Based on the fact that they've got enough test points, you got to make sure you have enough test points, enough telemetry points, so you can gather enough data. There's always a bit of a conflict of interest there, because it takes money and time and volume and whatever to put on all these self-test points. I can't even get the abbreviation to use for those on the hardware that I've worked on. I think you said 2 Octobers ago there was a similar explosion on the launch pad. And do you remember what was the causative agent of that? I think you were starting to describe that the holding structure for the helium tank, the helium vessel inside of the main fuel tank, somehow that had failed up all WS2N, K2IW.
Yeah, 2 Junes ago, so not this June, but past June, at the end of the month, I think it was the 28th, they had a launch to the space station, CRS number 8, and they were bringing up the IDA, the International Docking Adapter, that they were going to put onto the space station, where, you know, by doing that, you eventually would have the capability of docking American spacecraft, such as the Dragon or the Starliner by Boeing to the International Space Station. That thing, when that went up, it was up for almost 2 minutes away from the launch complex, and then it blew up and completely destroyed the whole, not only the rocket, but took out the NASA spacecraft with it. So, that was, they determined the cause was a helium tank located in the second stage of the oxygen tank within the tank, you know, a tank within a tank, and that tank contains helium, and they think that tank from the acceleration, you know, they're pushing probably, you know, mark 5 or 6 or something by that time, and they think the acceleration with, you know, when you have that, you know, let's say 5 G's, if it's a 1,000-pound tank, and now it's a 5,000-pound tank, broke a strut. You know, one of the struts that were holding the tank in place, and they found out that all the struts in the Falcon 9 were inadequate by the supplier. So they changed suppliers, changed the struts, and really improved the tanks for, you know, for reflying the Falcon 9. So, you know, the helium serves the purpose of, you know, when oxygen starts going through the turbo pumps and being used up, it creates a void within inside the oxygen tank. They don't want that. They don't want a void. They want a constant pressure on there. So helium is released into the oxygen tank to keep everything pressurized until all the fuel and oxygen is depleted. Back to you there.
Gemini, this is YB5MKI, Portable Whiskey 2.
Okay, YB5, Portable Whiskey 2. Tell us your name, and do you want to give us a piece of information? Go ahead.
Okay, my friend, this is YB5MKI, Portable Whiskey 2. My name is Philip, Papa Hotel India, Lima, India, Papa. Kia ora.
Okay, we've got you, Philip, and do you want to give us a piece of information or a question? Go right ahead, Philip.
Okay, nothing information. My QTH is Brooklyn, okay? Back to you, my friend.
Understand. Yeah, we're running a net right now, which is called the technical net, where people do ask questions or give us information, if you know what I mean, with reference to ham radio type things and space. We just had the space report from Paul. What I could do right now is I give you my information that I've derived on the question that was asked last week by Ed, KC2PYT. He was asking the question of what do we have to go through to fulfill the FCC requirement for confirming that our ham radio operation is within the safe areas of radio frequency biohazard. And I did promise Ed that I would work up those numbers and show him how that test could be done. And if we don't have any other questioners at this time or any other information that Paul wants to give us or any other mailbag questions, then maybe this is the right time to do that. Let me pass it around to John and Paul in that order just to make sure. So is that what we should do next, do you think, John? KC2WGB? KQRIW in the TechNet?
KC2WGB. Very good, Dick. I do have one question for Paul, which he doesn't have to answer this week, but maybe he could have an answer for me next week, if that's all right.
Why don't you fire away with your question right now?
Okay, I was wondering, the next mission for New Horizons, what has it been assigned to do? Where is it going, and what are they planning for it, if there has been? I know we talked about it a couple of months ago, but I haven't heard anything new. So maybe Paul has some info on that. Back to you, Dick.
You've got it, Paul.
Okay, John, the next contact with another object, a type of object, would be January 1st, 2019. So a couple of years down the road from now, and that's all been approved. And we'll look forward to that, and I'll get some more details on it, and we'll talk about it again next week. But that's, it's going to pass a 30-mile, should I say mile, or should I say, should we use kilometers, but a 30-mile diameter thing that this is going to pass. So, a Kuiper belt object. So we'll look forward to that. And all the information still isn't back from Pluto. It's still sending information. And I just want to make sure if anybody pays attention to the news, next week on the 8th, OSIRIS-REx will be going up, and that will be going to an asteroid quite a few years from now. But the launch is from Cape Kennedy, and it wasn't damaged during the explosion. It was on Launch Complex 41. Back to you, Jack.
And who is the organization that's doing that launch, Paul? I suspect that is or is not Elon Musk. Go ahead.
Yeah, now, of course, that's a NASA JPL type of thing, but the people that are launching it is United Launch Alliance, ULA, and it's a combination of Lockheed and Boeing, they're the ones that launch all these Atlas V rockets. They've launched the Delta IV rocket, the Delta IV heavy rocket, the Delta II rocket. They've been doing all this before Elon Musk ever got on the scene. And they launch all the top secret payloads for NRO. That's the National Reconnaissance Office. They call it the ULA, the United Launch Alliance. It's basically Boeing and Lockheed together. It's going to be launched on an Atlas V rocket. The 421 configuration. Back to you there.
And that launch pad, which launch pad is that going to be using up, Paul? Go ahead.
Yeah, it's LC 41. That's the Boeing Atlas. That's the complex they've been using for years for all the Atlas rockets, I think, since 2002. So it's nearby number 40, just south of it. This complex is just north of it. And OSIRIS-REx and the Atlas V rocket were inside the building at the time. You know, they have a launch facility building. So it was protected there. If anything did fly by, but I don't think anything did get that far. Back to you, Dick.
Yeah, I should have recognized you did say it was 41. So the spacing between 41 and 40 is great enough that the explosion going on 40, essentially none of that damaged anything on launch pad 41, is what I think you're saying, Paul. Go ahead.
Yes, the distance is roughly, I think they say about 1.5 miles between each complex, so it's okay. It was quite a blast, but didn't get that far. They did tell the residents of the area to stay inside, not because of the kerosene fuel, but because of the hypergolic fuel from the satellite itself. From on board the satellite, they have that fuel, and that's very poisonous. But no injuries, no damage for people's health anyway. Back to you, Dick.
Would you be able to make a guess, Paul, as to what percentage of fueling had taken place at the time of the explosion? Do you think maybe they had 90% of all the fuel on board when it occurred? Go ahead.
Yeah, I think it was 93, I think I read. I forget the exact number, but it was over 90. And they were, within a couple of minutes of actually lighting off the rockets. Wasn't going anywhere, but they do that, like I said in the beginning, on a regular basis. By the way, Atlas doesn't do that. They don't do that anymore. They did many, many years ago. But Elon Musk still does it. So I guess it's a choice of the companies that are involved, how reliable the equipment is or whatever it is. They're not required, I guess, to do that. I know Atlas doesn't do it.
If I understand correctly, Paul, this was going to be a test firing on the launch pad. I presume that the only thing you're firing is the engines on the very first stage, and maybe you fire those engines one at a time for a brief period of time. The engines on the second stage, I don't think you can fire them in this situation. Am I correct in all that, Paul? WS2N, K2IW.
Yeah, it's just the 9 engines. I understand they all go off at one time. But, I mean, it's like a second or two. That's it. And then they shut them right down. And they wait a couple of days. And then they do it for real. Atlas does I think they call it a wet test, or basically, they fuel the tank, all the tanks, and make sure there's no leaks or anything, but they just don't fire the engines. SpaceX does.
So there's 9 engines on the bottom of this event that took the explosion. 9 engines, all engines are going to be run simultaneously for 1 or 2 seconds, if I understand correctly. And does that bring them up to full thrust that you confirm that they're all in good working order? And because those engines have been previously tested before they were shipped to Florida, I guess I'm a little bit curious as to why they feel they have to be tested again. Over to you, Paul, K2IW.
That's their system, I don't know. Like I said, Atlas isn't doing it. Atlas has really one big engine on theirs, the RD-180. So they don't have this, you know, this octagon, octaweb, or what they call it. You know, they don't have all these engines like that SpaceX does. So there might be a reason for it. Don't know. That's my guess. Also, Atlas is usually launched with solid rockets. Sometimes they're not, but naturally, solid rockets can't be tested in that fashion. You know, once they ignite, they're gone forever. There's no shutting them off.
So the test firing was going to be for a very short period of time. I am guessing that performing, they're proving that the full thrust of all engines equally thrusting can be confirmed. When you do one of these test firings, have they ever canceled a launch because they saw some kind of a glitch during the test firing? Does the test firing really detect something that can't be detected any other way, Paul? WS2N, K2IW.
In the beginning, they had, you know, before they, when they started getting ready to launch these rockets, there were things that would happen, and they would look into it, and you might be delayed a couple of days. Or, in fact, they might have, I think one time they did bring it back. They didn't like something, they brought it back to the hangar. And that's exactly what happened to the one in Virginia, Wallops Island. They test fired that a couple of months ago, and it all looked good, but then they said there were some extra vibrations that they're looking at. So they've been working on that for a while. So, you know, in essence, that's, you know, that's happening right now as we're speaking, but, you know, with another company. That's Orbital ATK that launches launches Antares from Wallops Island.
Okay, so there was a case where the test firing showed something that had to be detected. And then I guess some form of modification was made when they saw that extra vibration. And they made that modification and then did the test firing again and then the launch. Is that what happened at Wallops Island? Paul, go ahead. K2IW.
Everything up until the end, they haven't launched it yet. That should be coming up. It was scheduled for the end of this month, but I think it's going to go in October. And that's a Cygnus spacecraft that's going to be, you know, a cargo craft that's going to the International Space Station. But that's a new engine. That's brand new engines. Much more powerful. They call them RD-181s. So, we'll see what happens with that. You know, that's Orbital ATK. Again, they have these billion-dollar contracts with NASA, to supply the space station. I think they've done four or five. Let's see, one, two, three, four. Yeah, they've done four successfully so far. And I think this will be their fifth. Back to you, Ben.
If Cygnus is bringing up cargo to the International Space Station, and I think that used to be done by Progress, does that mean Progress is no longer being used? Paul, go ahead.
Yeah, well, there's been a lot of cargo ships that have docked with the space station to resupply them. I think there's, let's see, there's five. There was the ATV by European Space Agency. They're not flying anymore. They flew five flights one a year. They bought up a tremendous amount of cargo.